Good morning, everybody. I'm Larry Weissoon. If you enjoy real-world hunting and fishing talk, you're really going to enjoy listening to my good friend, Luke Clayton, and his guest for the next hour.
This is David Fox, and welcome to Outdoors with Luke Clayton and Friends. Luke has been a recognized outdoors writer for the past 3 decades and writes for a host of outdoor publications. Luke pens a weekly newspaper outdoors column that appears in over 40 Texas newspapers. Luke is on the pro staff of Pyramid Air, your one-stop shop for everything air gun related. Smoking techs, electric smokers, feel free to contact Luke through his website, catfishradio.org. Now let's join Luke and his guests for this week's show.
Well, thank you guys and friends. It is campfire talk time with Mr. Larry Weissoon. Larry is right here with me, and I thought we would have some fun this morning, maybe talking about how things used to be when Larry and I were boys, which was a long, long time ago. Hunting and fishing has changed a whole bunch, though, in Texas, all over, actually. Right, Larry? Thank you for being here, by the way, buddy.
Oh, it was a pleasure. And you're right. Things have really changed. I happened to give a talk not very long ago to the Texas Outdoor Writers Association and their annual convention down on the Texas coast. And that was kind of one of the things that I kind of touched upon of how things have changed over the years, and particularly in terms of the amount of game that's available and hunting, the type of hunting that we do, how we hunt, you know, the increases in technology compared to what it used to be. And, you know, when I first started hunting, you're right, it's been many, many years ago, you know, several lifetimes for some of our listeners when you get right down to it. But, you know, we didn't wear camo back then. There was no, you know, there was a little bit of World War II camo, and the clothing that we wore a lot of times, I wore Army surplus wool shirts and those kind of things when it was cold. And, you know, the technology and clothing has increased a whole lot. But my first firearm back then, of course, 22 rimfires were legal. And my first deer rifle was a Remington Model 33 single shot 22. You know, these are not, those things are illegal. That was actually the first bolt action that Remington had ever come out with. Very few people had scopes. Very few people had binoculars. Rangefinders were what you did within your mind in looking at something. And, you know, all those kind of things have changed. And be honest about it, back then we had a lot of people who were good at woodsmanship. Over the years, it seems like, you know, from that perspective, we've taken what used to be between your left ear and your right ear and put it at a fingertip, to where now you got to push. You don't have to do a whole lot of thinking along those lines. So there have been a lot of changes, including particularly in terms of equipment.
Well, Larry, hold that thought. I want you to take a minute here and brag on all the people that make it possible for us to do campfire talk. Then we're going to kick back off and talk about how things were back in the day. So the mic is yours, buddy.
I appreciate that, because our segment is brought to everybody by DSC, Conservation Education Hunter Advocacy, the finest conservation hunting organization there is in the world. Hornady, accurate, deadly, dependable. Of course, when we're talking about Hornady, started in about 1940 something and other, and so they've been around since those years we're talking about. Stealth Vision, which produces the finest hunting optics, whether it's scopes, spotting scopes, binoculars, or even red dot sights, you know, those kind of things, put out there by Dr. John McCall and his guys at Crockett, Texas, not too far, kind of halfway between you and where you and I live.
Yep.
And then, of course, Taurus. Now, Taurus has been around for a long time, and as a lot of people know, I love to hunt with handguns. My favorite handguns are those Taurus Ragent Hunters and 44 Mag and 454 Kapoor and others. But, you know, and then, too, Choctaw Hunting Lodge. Oh, my God, the finest place in the world as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, all those bring, as I talked about those, DSC has been around for 40-plus years now, and Hornady has been around longer than that. I think just had their 70th or 75th anniversary or whatever it was there not very long ago. And so, you know, lots of good things out there going on.
You bet.
Things have changed.
Things have changed. And you mentioned in your first – my second firearm was a J.C. Higgins 22 single shot. I wish I had not got rid of that thing when I was a teenager, but I did. I remember it had a knurled bolt, and you pull that bolt back.
That's the way this
and,
one is.
And I remember when I was about 9. I'll tell you in a bit about the first firearm I had, but I remember how hard it was to pull that thing back. I mean, they did have a hard spring on them, especially for a 8 or 9 year old kid, you know. but I'd get it back, and then I'd wear those squirrels out. But my first firearm was a Mossberg 410 bolt action, and that was one had the built in magazine where you slid the shell, push the shell down from the top. And my Uncle Jack Connor, he was worked for Diebold Safe and Lock Company. He traveled. He was one of their main guys. He traveled all over the country working in banks and installing new upgraded systems, you know, bank vaults and things like that. That's what he did. So he came through one time, and he had that little Mossberg 410, I never will forget, and a whole box of shells, which was, you know, back in those days, shells were a rare. You didn't go out and blast up 25 shells at a tin can back then.
No, I didn't.
So anyway, I never will forget standing on the bank of our little old pond. We had about a half acre pond there on the place where I grew up, and I stood on the bank of that and shot down into the water. I remember thinking, oh man, this thing kicks. I mean, you know, as a 410, and I was almost afraid to shoot it, but I got accustomed to it. So I killed a bunch of squirrels with that gun. If I ever find the same Mossberg shotgun in 20 gauge at my friend's pawn shop in Seagoville, Texas. But I want a 410. That was, if people that are familiar with those old Mossbergs, the safety, it was ideal for a kid. It had a red plastic looking dot, and then a red one, and then a green one, right there where the lever was to move it from safe to fire. Ideal firearm for a youngster. But I wore the quail out. I didn't shoot many in the air, but they better not get on a straightaway running away from me when I was a kid. And that was my first gun, and then the little 22, the J.C. Higgins was my second one. And by then, I'd learned a little bit, you know, BB guns. I'd shot rifles enough to kind of get the basic premise of it. But that's how I started. And Larry, you know, back in, we're talking, folks, in 1958, I was 8 years old. So that's the time frame that I'm talking about. And it wasn't like here's a box of 22 longs. Or used to it was 22 shorts, longs, and long rifles. Right, Larry? You know?
Yes, sir. You're exactly right.
Now I haven't seen a box of shorts or longs. I haven't. Maybe they don't even make them. I don't know. But it's all long rifles, and that's good. But, you know, it wasn't like take this 50 22 shorts and go out there and shoot a can. No, it was like, they might be a box, but you better save them and use them for squirrels and rabbits and stuff, right? You just didn't. That was back then. And Larry, deer hunting, we lived on 30 acres. I grew up that we had a little bit more than that, but I know my dad gave my grandfather a few acres, and when he moved from a cabin up in Red River County to a frame house there, this was back in probably the early 50s. But deer, I remember vividly a buck. I had the measles or something in the wintertime. It was about January. And behind our house, we had a hay meadow about, 20 acre coastal Bermuda. On the chicken, my dad raised poultry, and he put that chicken manure on there, and all those ranchers were hot to trot to get that hay, you know.
Absolutely.
They really were. They almost fought for it. But I remember, I was homesick, you know, with the measles or something, and I looked out the back window. You could see down between the two chicken houses back into that meadow. To this day, I think it was a big buck. I mean, to me back then, it looked huge, but it was a high-antlered big old buck come through, and man, that lit a fire. That was the first wild deer I ever saw in my life. And there were very, very few deer back in those days, Larry. And I know it was the same way down in Southeast Texas where you lived, right?
It was, because I grew up about halfway between Houston and San Antonio, and a little bit closer to Houston. But, you know, you're right. We had the deer season opened November 16th. It closed at dark or whatever it was on mm-hmm. December the 31st.
Yep.
And back in those years when I first started hunting, my God, if you saw a deer track, you were just thrilled no end. If you actually saw a deer, oh my God, it's even better.
Yep.
And whoever shot a deer in those early years in our area, I mean, he was a hero for the entire community, for that little rural community of Zimmerjai. For weeks, if not months, kind of thing. And then we finally got rid of the screw worms back in the late 50s and early 60s and into the middle 60s. But when that happened, though, that deer population across Texas and across the Southeast actually just really started blossoming. And all of a sudden we had deer. And then we went from not having any deer to having way too many of them. And then finally they started managing them a little bit. You know, in terms of taking those and bucks kind of thing, and things really changed. But yeah, it was a different time. You know, you, these days almost anybody that goes deer hunting, they really expect not only to see a deer, they expect to take a deer. And back then, you just hope you got to see one.
Larry, was the eradication of the screw worm, was that the major thing for the deer boom that took place really? Looking back, of course, I lived through it. The mid-60s, they started getting more and more plentiful. And in the 70s, the East Texas was loaded with deer, you know. Was a screw worm, was that a major factor? I guess it was.
It was a major factor because you just didn't have any fawns that hardly survived. And, of course, after a while, you didn't hardly have any deer because of that. But the screw worm is the larval stage of which we've got it back in Mexico, and there's a tremendous amount of work being done now to prevent it, to try to keep it out of Texas, and then should it get here, to try to control it. But it's a flesh-eating larva, and what happens is they lay eggs on any kind of wound, and a lot of time that meant where the navel cord was, and mm-hmm. those screw worms would literally eat those fawns from inside out kind of thing. And so once we did that, they figured out that a screw worm female fly only mated one time and then laid eggs. And so they applied radiation.
Yeah.
And they applied radiation to billions of flies and dropped them. And so essentially they kind of bred the screw worm out of existence for a long time, particularly here in Texas and the northern edge of Mexico. And then, but they were over into, you know, all the way across the Southeast. When that happened, we finally started getting some reproduction. Then when we started getting reproduction too, about the same time, there's still a fair amount of trapping and relocating of deer being done to restock some of the areas where they previously had deer. Well, with the screw worm gone, then the fawns that were born in those areas, and that's really, when you get right down to it, it was because of the eradication of the screw worm, along with people paying attention and a little bit of stocking, that's what brought the deer population back throughout the South.
Well, Larry, hold that thought. I'm being told we need to take a quick break, but let's come back. Okay. We haven't had enough time. We want to talk about how fishing was back in those days
and
some more stuff. So stick with me, folks. We'll take a break. We're coming right back. Well, friends, Mr. Larry Wysoon is going to tell you about the finest hunting optics that we have ever found.
Luke, these are called Stealth Vision. They come from Crockett, Texas. Dr. John McCall developed them. They're 34-millimeter tubes as opposed to the narrower tubes, so more light transmission. They have a little green light that comes on when that scope is leveled, because that's when you want to pull the trigger. They have an optional lighted reticle as well, too, and a whole lot of other products, and folks can learn more about them by going to stealthvision.com.